Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah. Happy days.
Hello, and welcome to this. It is the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby. Doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. I am JB, here with Phil. Hello, Phil.
Hello, JB.
And Tim down the line. Where are you, Tim? You're in a studio somewhere.
I'm at News UK in London Bridge, home of Virgin Radio and TalkSport.
Wow.
Both of which I've been on air with today, hence I'm down the line.
Were you doing your rugby show?
Yes. They obviously kept me for the big gun. They said, it's all right, Tim. We'll save you from the four Home Nations games yesterday and you can work on Japan, France. We need the big guns for that one.
Exactly. You need the knowledge, don't you? You can't just work that and sort of guess your way through it.
Yeah, and my penance is next week. They've said, look, unfortunately, you're going to have to go to Twickenham and work on the England game. So, yeah.
Who is it next week?
Roundabouts.
South Africa.
South Africa.
Yeah.
Ooh, tasty. Very, very tasty.
But before we get onto any sort of rugby chat, just a quick welfare check. Are you all right, JB? Because your voice sounds a bit hoarse.
A couple of days worth of drinking, mate. So, yeah. Me and Phil had a few beers last night, and we had a few more beers on Friday night in Manchester. And you didn't come.
I'm sorry about Friday night. There was a point at which, because we'd said we were going to go out after playing a Vets game against Wilmslow.
Yes, this is true.
What I'd forgotten is that Louis had his Sail Sharks development DPP thing.
How did that go?
I completely forgot about that. So I would have had to bail on the rugby game were it not cancelled anyway. But consequently, it just made, bearing in mind I was heading down to London and doing work, but anyway, it just made Friday night. By the time I got back home, and it was too late. But I feel bad.
How was DPP? Sorry? What do you think of that scenario over there?
It's good coaching they get. It's really good. It's cool. Yeah, rugby's different to football. So there's one lad who plays in our under-15s rugby team, and his brother is on the books at United, and he's 14. I think he's 15 years of age now. I think basically if you're in an academy, a premiership academy, age 15, you're basically going to earn a living from playing football at some level.
Yeah.
You're that good. Whereas rugby, I think it's very much more like the development of players physically has such a bearing that it doesn't matter if you miss out now. And if you're in now, you might be the best player in your age group, but another couple of years, you won't be as effective.
Yeah, quite possibly. Or you might just change position.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, so it was interesting to watch. I picked up loads of coaching tips.
So I used to have a client who was a coach at United. I've not seen this guy now for a long time because he's retired. But he was an ex-teacher and he did some ridiculously young age group, like under eights or something.
Yeah.
So they need a goalkeeper, right? And they'll go through hundreds of lads to find their goalkeeper for under eights. But here's another thing they do as well. Their kit is made by Adidas. Well, it was made by Adidas. Don't know if it still is.
But same as the first team kit at a point in time.
Yeah.
And it still is by Adidas now.
Yeah, so Adidas supply United with the first team kit.
Yeah.
So when these kids go to United to play, and they're divvied up into teams and they're playing small-sided games and whatnot, they're never allowed to wear the Manchester United kit until they become a Manchester United player. That's why they're always in, like, Germany kits or any other international kit which Adidas supplies.
Ah, but not United.
Never get to wear it.
Until you're the real deal.
Yeah. I like that.
I like that.
Yeah, make it special.
I'll just do a little bit of the housekeeping. Thank you for listening. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. We're the only podcast there for you every single Monday morning. And we're there for you 52 weeks of the year. And we've been there for over 9 years now into our 10th season. And if you appreciate that, hit subscribe. Go to patreon.com/eggchasers. And yeah, we got a lot to pick the bones out of today, lads.
Yeah, haven't we, Jess? Well, before we go on, a bit of a mea culpa. I need to correct the record. I did a whole story last week about how a ref watched a kick go over the posts.
Yes.
And what I actually meant to say is the exact opposite. The ref did not see a kick go over the posts against Tarleton. He saw a kick miss the posts, but he did see the kick. So you go back and listen to that, and I don't know how I managed to say the polar opposite to what I actually meant. But yeah, that happened.
It does make more sense now.
It makes a lot more sense now. A lot more sense. So I am very, very sore today. I played second team rugby for the first time in ages. I played a horrible, horrible game. And then I went drinking, and now I am in a world of trouble.
And you were drinking the day before that as well.
I was.
We finished drinking at maybe 2 or 3 a.m.
Something like that.
On the Friday night.
Yeah. Yeah, it was
all kinds of toxic masculinity going on already on the podcast.
Well, I'll tell you what, mate. I ended up being introduced to the Masters women's record holder power lifter for the UK. She was very...
Wow, that's...
She was awesome.
Very impressive. Awesome. Yes.
Could really lift.
Yes. Yeah, that was quite good fun.
That's very cool.
Isn't it? So where do you want to start then?
For me, it's got to be England. There might be some argument to say start with Wales, but I just saw less of that game, so I can talk about it less. But I'd rather start with England, but happy to go wherever you boys want to go.
Well, okay, did you watch England?
Yes.
Well, let's start with England then.
Watched the whole of the first half live. I was kind of dipping in and out of the second half live because it was bath time and bedtime and all the rest of it. But I rewatched the second half this morning. So I've watched it all and some of it twice.
So that first half was truly dreadful. Would you agree with that?
The England performance was truly dreadful.
Yeah.
England performance was absolutely awful. I thought the New Zealand performance was very, very good. Very accomplished, very clinical.
Yeah, but the two are, you cannot, one doesn't come without the other. Like, I think it's important that you said New Zealand were excellent.
Yes.
Because I think Eddie Jones was correct when he said we were only 2 or 3% off. I didn't think England were terrible. It's just New Zealand were really good, and that does happen at the highest level. And it's important, and it's a very English thing to do to write off a really comfortable win against Japan because it's only Japan, and to get really up in arms when you lose by a point to Argentina because you feel like you've got a divine right to beat Argentina. And similarly, New Zealand had an exceptional first half, and yes, they completely rocked England. It was poor by their standards, but the two things are important.
Yeah, putting the two things together, even with how well New Zealand played, there was so much frustration from me in the way that England played in that first half. And it was the old mistakes, the mistakes that we've seen many, many times where they get into good positions and are just sloppy around the ball. They don't look after the ball, they don't protect the ruck. Or the absolute criminal, stupid penalties being compounded by stupid penalties, like giving three consecutive penalties in a row and New Zealand 100 yards of field position just for silly, silly offside, then flopping on, off your feet at a breakdown, and then something else brain dead. So that first half was a very good performance by New Zealand, but it was very poor by England.
Yeah, the set piece for England was poor. Incredibly poor, actually.
It was a mixed bag, I thought.
Go on.
Well, the first half, if you take the scrum,
yep.
New Zealand win scrum penalty, dominant scrum. Then England win a scrum penalty, dominant scrum. So,
well, England only won 60% of their scrums.
They won a few scrum penalties as well.
So, I look at this England team, and outside of Tom Curry and Courtney Laws when he's fit, I just think they look lightweight. I just don't think they're big enough around the park. I don't think they've got enough world-class players. Maybe outside of Maro. Maybe Maro at six. But I just don't know where the quality is going to come from for this team.
I think they have got enough quality. And I think it was very interesting to see the performance of the... What do England call them? Finishers.
Yes.
In the pack. Because I thought... You would argue that the finishers, the five finishers who were on the bench for the pack, Jimmy George, Mako, Will Stewart, Ribbons, and Jack Willis, they're not as good as the people that they were replacing. But I'd say to a man, they all perform better than the people that they replaced.
Well, I mean, I know Tim was talking in the week that he expected a Will Stewart double off the bench. but Dave Ribbons for me was an absolute revelation.
He was class, and that offload.
Yeah.
But I actually think the best...
That was his second offload in that move. He did two offloads out the back like that in that one try. Which, by the way, let's just balance up some of the concerns with the positives. That Freddie Stewart try was one of the best England tries I have ever seen.
Yeah. Ooh, big shout.
I think it was. I think it was
a good try. Definitely a very good try.
It was like a full team move from, 80 metres?
Inside their own 22.
Yeah.
And finished with just the most rapid ball, brilliant decisions, great attacking shape, fabulous hands. Dave Ribbons twice with the offloads. It was an amazing try.
And I think the players that came on, I thought, obviously, Will Stewart got a lot of plaudits for finishing the two tries, but I thought Mako was amazing. Mako looked absolutely brilliant. He was carrying multiple yards on multiple phases in very, very quick succession. But we spoke about the first half, which was good from New Zealand and bad from England. The second half, you've got the last 8 minutes, which stands alone. But I thought England were the better team for the majority of the second half. They just couldn't get the points on the board.
Yeah, it did feel like they had quite a lot going on for them.
They had a lot of territory. They had a lot of possession. They had a lot of control over it. They forced some odd decisions from New Zealand, forced them to try and run it from their own line, which obviously they did successfully once with the crossfield kick for Riku Ioane, but they forced them to try and do it multiple other times, and England generally got out on top. They forced that odd little dink over the top from TJ Perenara with 6 minutes to go, maybe, that invited more pressure and led to the second try. So I think overall England were comfortably the better team for the majority of the second half, which you don't often say against New Zealand, because New Zealand are so fit. They ordinarily put 10 more points on the opposition in the second half and towards the end of the second half. So this was a weird reversal of that. But that last 8 minutes, everything that had kind of gone wrong in the rest of the second half just went right. And they changed up the way they played. They played a lot more rugby. They played wider with more depth, with more pace. And they did look brilliant for that last 8 minutes.
Yeah, there's a few things about New Zealand here. First thing is, they are obviously still very dangerous. That first half shows what opportunists they are.
Well, they're three tries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Clinical. The Papali'i one is a great read. The Cody Taylor one, just exploiting space, putting pressure on. And then the Riku Ioane was just a wonderfully executed little identification
of
space.
And tactically, they'd obviously spotted something, and that crossfield kick was just wrecking England and making the wingers not know where to be when. And so they'd done their homework and come up with a plan, and they just tore us to pieces in the first half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the counter to that is New Zealand are deeply and maybe critically flawed. You put pressure on New Zealand and they will ship points. They're not as tough as the New Zealand of old, or maybe they're not as smart as the New Zealand of old. I don't know which one it is. But there's something which is not quite right with them, because they can be fragile.
Well, if you look for the whole of the rest of the game and the whole of the rest of the second half, they defended very, very well on their own line. England had multiple phases, and at key moments, New Zealand either held them up or stopped them short or forced crucial turnovers. So for the majority of the game, they were winning that arm wrestle and winning outright. Now, they did what they struggled with in that second half was adequately exiting.
Yeah,
they struggled to properly relieve pressure when England built the pressure over and over again. But they handled it really well until that last 8 minutes. And maybe it's the difference in depth from the bench. When England's bench came on and the drop-off was not significant. Maybe there was a bit of a drop-off there for the New Zealand type five.
Let's just talk a bit more about England. So I've always said I'm not impressed with their pack. I'm not impressed with their pack. Like I said, I think Tom Curry is the only world-class player in there at the moment. Jack Van Portfleet didn't quite do enough for me to nail down the starting nine job. As much as I like the kid, I think he's a great player, he's not the starting nine yet.
Now, that is an interesting one. So he had a horrible game.
Yeah.
He had a horrible first half. He threw the intercept.
Dalton Papali'i.
Yeah. His kick-in was not great. There was one box kick in particular where it's one of the few times where England got quick front football in that first half, and he just did a little box kick to nothing with two men in the 22.
It's disappointing that, because he can really bang those box kicks. I mean, when it comes just to the physical ability to put length onto a kick, I think he's as good as anyone. So, as a shame that he goes down that decision-making route.
But it's the interesting thing now is, so I think reverting back to Ben Youngs would be the wrong thing to do.
Even though disaster.
Ben Youngs played great when he came on.
Mm-hmm.
But this was only Van Portfleet's third start.
Yeah.
And it's his biggest, highest profile start.
Like, you've got to say, if Danny Care played like that, he'd have been subbed much earlier and we'd never be playing for England again.
Yeah, and the fact that he made it to 53 minutes, I think, shows that Eddie Jones is going to stick with him. He will learn an enormous amount from that test. He will learn about pressure, he will learn about decision-making, he will learn what it's like, or he has experienced what it's like to play just about the best team in the world when they are playing at their best.
Yep.
I'd echo that, Phil. And I think there's a little bit, JB, if I might say, everything seems very reactive in what you're saying.
Oh, I watched the game and reacted to the game.
You watch the first half and England are dreadful. You watch the second half and you say New Zealand are weak and fragile.
Although they are.
You watch Van Portfleet have one horrible 53 minutes and say he shouldn't be England's starter.
Well, wait for this.
I don't know if England were not doing the fundamentals correctly in the first half. And yes, he had a particularly poor game, and actually with good ball off the top of the line out, he should have spotted Papali'i. And yeah, so he had a poor game. I'm not making no excuses for that. But New Zealand absolutely ripped into England's breakdown. And the ball that he did have most of the time was dreadful. And he was clearly under pressure. And like Phil says, he will learn. And England as a team will learn about how you have to take care of those basics. It shouldn't be a lesson they need to learn, but nonetheless, they will.
Yeah, basics are important. Manu, what did we think of Manu?
His break... when he snuck round the back of Marcus Smith, breaking the second half was excellent. I think it was Bowden Barrett made a brilliant. It was either Bowden or Richie Munger made a brilliant stop on him 5 meters from the line. Other than that, fairly quiet.
Do you think I think this coincides with his whole sale career. To be honest, it looks like a declining star.
He's still got a lot of positives, but England have just not found the way to use him. In England, it did. England's revival and better performance, it coincided with a few things, but it did coincide with Slade coming on. Although
it did.
He's a hell of a player.
This is it. I think this is a lag from the last World Cup, and South Africa won the World Cup by bullying teams and steamrolling them and physically just out-muscling teams. And mm-hmm. I think, obviously, every other international team went back to the drawing board and said, right, we need to address that. And now, as we are 3 years on from that and 10 months out from the next World Cup, every international team that's worth their salt can cope with massive men running in straight lines, which is what Manu does. And there is a place for that.
Until you can't.
It can be effective. It can be very effective.
Yeah.
And there's a place for it. However, I just think if you're going to unlock France and South Africa and New Zealand and these top international teams, then I just think Slade is the way. And he's not small.
No, he's not. He's a huge man.
Yeah, he's not... He doesn't hit like Manu, but he's very few people really do.
Yeah, I just think with Manu, he is starting to decline. I don't think he's generating the force that he used to generate. You see every now and again, he will absolutely whack someone, but then you don't see that for like a prolonged period of time. It's the carrying as well. The carrying doesn't have the violence that it once did. You know, he used to make that outside break and it'd be unstoppable. You know, you see the odd hard hit or the odd hard... direct running line, but it's just not the same thing.
Yeah, I do wonder how much of it is down to England not using him correctly. But then...
he's back at 13 now.
He is.
There's no excuses there.
Yeah. It's hard to know. It is hard to know. But England looked much better when Manny was off the field. They also, weirdly, look better when Guy Porter was playing on the wing.
Guy Porter's
which,
a beast.
Which is not something I would recommend going forward, but it works. It worked this week.
Well, he plays for Leicester on the wing quite frequently.
No. He's not an answer to England on the wing. Well,
but does he play for Leicester? Yeah, Potter. Potter plays Potter, on the wing.
You're Porter. Thinking of Harry Potter.
No, not.
How many games has he played on the wing? Because I can't...
A good handful.
I can't recall any with him.
And he moves around a lot, too. So he might not start on the wing, but he'll end up on the wing quite frequently. I think he's a great player. I think he's just muscular. He bangs. He goes forward. He simplifies everything that you want to do. I think the brightest spot in England's performance is Freddie Stewart, who is kind of undoubtedly the starting 15, though. I mean, there's got not very much argument there.
Johnny May was great as well. He's been someone that's been a lot of people have been unhappy that he's being picked over guys that are more in form and just as rapid, like Hassel Collins and Radwan and co. But Johnny May was great.
He was great.
Good.
I thought he looked really good. I thought he was very solid under the high ball. His positioning was very good, and he carried when he needed to and beat defenders and looked dangerous and looked fast. So no complaints there at all.
Now there is, of course, two players we haven't spoke about yet.
Go on.
And they'll be the ones that get the most scrutiny. Johnny, Marcus Smith and Owen Farrell Access. Did that work for you?
First half, no. But they never... It wasn't on them. They never... The team never got ball. The team never strung more than two phases together. So it's hard to blame the first half on them. I thought second half they were very good. And...
Yeah.
The last 10 minutes in particular, obviously the last 10 minutes is when it all stuck and all went well. But those two really did look excellent.
Tim?
Yeah, I think that they were both really good. I think Owen Farrell, actually, I thought he had a really excellent game. And yeah, I was perfectly happy. I've never had a problem with this particular combination. And when I was doing I was just looking back at some old stuff and Owen Farrell started his England career at inside centre. I personally don't understand the fuss that people make about Owen Farrell at inside centre.
It's just
he was a 12 at Saracens. He played plenty in the centre at Saracens when he first came in. He started his international career at 12. He's the best 10 in England, possibly the best 10 in the world, and he's also the best 12 in England.
I mean, you could make that argument, certainly. It wouldn't be the argument that I'd be busy making. But
Just looking at this performance, what was your view?
I thought they were adequate. You know, that's what I thought. I thought they sometimes did things well. I think Marcus Smith is still not operating at his Harlequins levels, not by a long shot. I think they'd be better off probably with someone like George Ford at 10. Or if you really think Owen Farrell is the answer, just put Owen Farrell at 10. This 10-12 thing, it sometimes works, but it's too infrequent for me, and I think it's too restraining for Marcus Smith. And was Marcus Smith acting under orders when he kicked the ball out for the draw?
I don't think so. So have you seen
Eddie Jones said on the matter was that it was he trusts the players making the decisions on the field and he backs them up in what they say. So that kind of wasn't an answer on exactly where the call came from and who it was.
Well, Eddie Jones did say he does not tell his players what to do in situations like that.
Exactly.
He trusts them. And Owen Farrell said we treated it like anything else. When we're in that position in that part of the field, we'll try and get front football. If we've got front football, we'll have a look at to see what's on. If it's on, we'll go. If it's not on, we'll play. We'll do the sensible thing.
I mean, I think it's nuts. I think you've got three tries in 7 minutes. You've got momentum on your side. It's a one-off test match. You want to win the game. I can't understand why you kick it out. Or at least
it's really hard to look at the counterfactual. I don't know what the truth is about what you would say, but I wonder if let's say Owen Farrell, a skipper, had told his team to go for it and it had messed up and backfired and they lost the game. I wonder whether you would have been saying, see, Owen Farrell, that's a terrible decision. See, Owen Farrell's use. You can't do that.
Well, are you happy?
We
with
don't
the
know
draw?
The counterfactual, but I wonder what people, and you included, JB, would have said.
Are you happy with the draw?
I at the time, I was happy.
No, you weren't.
I was genuinely.
You were happy with all that momentum, all that try scoring, all those points accumulated in 7 minutes, and you kick the ball out. I'm not having it.
It's a friendly.
It's not friendly. Yeah, it's a test match.
But it's a friendly.
My thought on it is that had they gone for it and had a go, and whether that had been successful or not, that would have been a great experience of having to try and get a result with time running out with a World Cup 10 months away. They might find themselves in that position.
Agreed.
You don't have to practice the we're drawing, we'll take the draw, kicking it out, because that's not something
that's
you have to
easy.
Practice. So
yeah.
So I guess kind of in terms of preparation and opportunities, you can practice scenarios in training as much as you want, but this was a real one and would have been quite useful from that perspective. But I'd also look at, rather, I'd look at, like we always talk about, with the, don't blame it on one refereeing decision, look at the 80 minutes. And when I look at the 80 minutes, I think we missed conversions we should have taken. And like you said, Phil, there's so many opportunities we left out on the field where we should have scored.
And all, in that decision, what I will say, like for me, in the warm, being warm and comfortable at home and actually wanting to go out for a beer, I was very happy with the decision to kick it out. Because England have got a test match next week as well that is important.
It's friendly.
If I was... Well, no, the learning's important, but the result, take it or leave it.
You know,
but if I was in the ground and you've had... Exactly to your point, JB, you've scored whatever it is, 19 points in 7 or 8 minutes, and all the momentum's with you. All Blacks have still got a man in the bin. You've been totally dominant for the last 8 minutes.
Yes.
You've got the 80,000 people, or what's left of the 80,000 people in Twickenham, all behind you. If I was there and I paid a few hundred pounds for a ticket and everything else, I would have been fuming.
Yeah.
I would have been absolutely fuming. But from the comfort of my home, I was absolutely fine with the decision.
I would say this, just the opportunity to put your team in a position where you need to get a win and you've got one chance and it's pressure. That's a very, very valuable opportunity that they've spurred there. And they should have worked with it.
They couldn't, but it would have been, exactly as Tim said, if they play there, because don't forget, England have got to go 80 metres. They're in their own 22 when then they kick that ball out. And knowing how whistle-happy Mathieu Reynal was for the whole game, and how much of a lottery many of the scrums were, many of the rooks and mauls were, I think it would have been crackers to do it.
I would have done it. 100% I would have done it. I think Marcus Smith, in his most natural incarnation, would have done it too. But I think
It was Marcus Smith's call.
I think he was under orders. That's personally what I think. I think Owen Farrell, Ben Young said, boot that ball out. Let's go home and have a beer.
So both Eddie and Owen said they didn't.
Well, the liars.
I do like that you know.
I do know. I know. Absolutely 100%. I know that. Now, just quick shout out to Twickenham itself. I thought the production values for this game before kickoff were absolutely outstanding. So I watched all of the Argentina-Scotland game, which was an absolute brawl. I don't know if either of you boys saw that.
I saw the first half, and then I saw some of the highlights, which included the Crema red card.
Yeah.
It's absolutely crackers. I saw bits of it.
Well, what Twickenham do, I don't know if you've noticed this, have you noticed that they don't show you the crowd? So if you ever watch a game at Twickenham, particularly when it's dark, they've got the floodlights on, they don't light up the crowd. So do you like a theatre audience? Mm-hmm. You've got the light on the stage, the actors can't see the crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
They do something similar with Twickenham. So Twickenham always seems all like very, very dark, except for the field of play. So when all the fireworks and whatnot were kicking off pre-game, that the pyrotechnics, the fireworks were going off, but the crowd is completely dark, and you sort of look at that compared to the Scotland game where they light up the crowd, and it just makes hell of a difference.
Mm.
It's just like all the focus is on that one thing. I think it looks absolutely brilliant.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I did like. They used that spider cam. And the best moment when they used it was the Dalton Papali'i try. Because from that angle, as soon as the ball's touched off the top, you can see he's out of the blocks.
Yeah.
And you can see from that angle, he's going to get this. He's going to get, no, JVP, no, don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, no, he's done it. Oh, it was such a good angle to pick up that moment
and
live.
Great anticipation.
It was great anticipation from Papali.
So, Tim, do we have any emails, mate?
Yeah, we've got a bunch, actually. I'll run through some emails in relation to the... Yeah. So this one comes from just signed off as Disappointed of Cheshire.
Oh, dear.
Saying, Dear Eddie, I've just spent £300 on a pair of tickets, £200 rail fare, £599 on hotels.
Wow.
Lots of money on expensive beer at Twickers for what I've been led to believe was going to be a competitive game. Would you be so kind as to let me know in advance in future when you decide your team is playing a friendly so I can spend my hard-earned cash on a holiday for my family or put a few more quid on the electric and gas account.
Where is this idea of a friendly come from? You've said it, Phil. Was it actually said somewhere? Someone said this.
It is a friendly, isn't it?
Is a test match a friendly?
Well, it's not...
If you get a cap for it, it's not a friendly.
A friendly is anything that's not in a multiple game competition. That's how
I don't like describing
don't about that.
Anything as friendly. Now, I don't like to, I don't, it, just because there's no pool points or league points or anything. I don't like the concept of friendly.
Well, So friendly is an interesting term because I would use it purely as in exactly as the definition that I've just given you. There is no consequence, good or bad, from winning or losing this game because the points do not accumulate. There is nothing else that this goes to. That is what a friendly means in my head. Mm. But that also means it doesn't actually matter if you win, lose, or draw because, exactly as I've just said, there's no consequence.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that you should just go into it without any aspect of any hope of winning. You should not care about the performance. But it just to my view, it didn't matter. And also the risk of the likelihood and risk, probability and impact of a penalty was such that if, to me, from where I was sat, it felt like the right decision. But I completely understand disappointed of Cheshire and what they are saying.
I'll rattle through some emails. Matt Robinson said, England's Marcus Smith is the subject title, and he just says it's like hiring a Michelin star chef to cook Weatherspoon's microwave meals.
Yeah, true.
Oh, dear. I think
it is an interesting one. Jay asked about it before, but I think England, as I said before, Smith and Farrell, they didn't get any chance in the first half because of New Zealand's dominance and England's poor performance and failure to put any phases together. I did think they looked overall better in the second half. I thought the combinations worked a bit better. And in that last 8-10 minutes, that's where you want them. I thought they were great.
Gareth Binmore says, New Zealand were dominant, but you have to hand it to England in the second half. They put pressure on the All Blacks, and in the last 10, seemed to play more like Quins. Very much unstructured play, playing what in front of you kind of approach. Couple that with heart and sheer determination to keep battling, and we managed to get a draw, which to be fair, isn't bad against an All Blacks team who've looked much better over the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. I saw one that was saying, I'm just trying to find it again, that said it was quite interesting to see the difference in the body language of the two teams. England, oh, here we go, it's from Joel, contact headchasers@gmail.com. It's very telling, both teams leave with a draw and England players look like they've won. New Zealand boys very much look like drawing is losing. Maybe those two mindsets have something to do with the traditional success of the nations.
I think it's more the trajectory at the end. It's not, if you'd have given both teams the option of a draw at the start, neither one would have taken it. If you'd given both teams the option of draw at 40 minutes, New Zealand definitely would not have taken it. England probably would have at that stage. And England being on the up in the last 10 minutes and New Zealand very much on the down, that's all that reflected.
Yeah. Got an email here from Bob Depledge, or however it is. Mm-hmm. I love the pod, blah, blah, blah. I've just watched Tim's Egg Chasers YouTube piece on Owen Farrell.
Excellent.
Yeah, I did a video which I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll release that just before England's game on YouTube because that will make it timely. Actually, not thinking, that just means nobody's going to look at it because they're all watching the England game.
True.
He says it's an educational 10 minutes for us all, like many of us we've had or think we've had cause to vilify Farrell for his style of play, discipline, etc. over the years. But what you've done in this 10-minute video is given us perspective and an evidence-based opinion on one of the greatest players ever to wear an England shirt. I can only ask you please plug the video on your pod so that Owen's detractors can wake up and smell the coffee. Mm. So there you go. I'm plugging it now.
Good.
Go to Egg Chasers on YouTube and have a look.
Excellent.
So anyone see the debacle in Cardiff?
I didn't really watch much of it live, but I have caught up with the amazing beards and amazing scrummaging.
It's quite something, wasn't it?
It's even more interesting, unusual, spectacular, considering how Wales started.
They were very strong.
After 25 minutes, two back-to-back Jack Morgan tries in 5 minutes, they looked great. They looked like they've just coast this. And then I'm not entirely sure what happened for the remaining 55 or so minutes.
Yeah, they were very...
Well, I'll tell you, before we dig into the detail, can we just start at the end and those scenes of Georgia winning?
Yes.
Were just very, very special.
Incredible, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, the scenes of the Georgian scrums.
That scrum for the penalty, the winning penalty with... 2 or 3 minutes to go, 3 or 4 minutes to go.
So you may or may not be aware that I'm a huge fan of the work of Ben Darwin. You may be aware of that.
Yeah.
You may not be. And the question was posed to Ben, who is the best player in the world? His response was?
Nene Ashvili.
Whoever wears the tight head prop shirt for Georgia. For Georgia. And I don't think he's wrong, you know.
Well, that whoever's wearing the number 18 shirt at that moment in time.
Whoever is playing tight head for Georgia at any single time ever is possibly the best player on the planet.
God, they've and, got some
One thing I love about Georgia winning this game and being really good is, and this, some people will criticise me for saying this.
Oh,
it's
please.
The sort of thing you're not allowed to say now in 2022.
Uh-oh.
But I love that this is a Tier 2 team with a side... full of players born and raised in Georgia. This is not stacked with South Africans playing
it's
for their
not, is it?
Nation.
Say again.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I can't see why anyone wouldn't love it, to be honest.
Yeah. There's probably a few French-born Georgians, but there'll be Georgians whose fathers played in France because that's where the money was in the 80s or 90s.
And 2000s.
And 2000s, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, you not many of that Georgian pack look like they were born.
They look so old, don't they?
Before about 1975.
They look all. I mean, they're all like 28 or something, but they look like
so grizzled and chiseled.
Garam Gogiashvili is 24 years old, 118 kilograms. No, he's not.
Do not believe that.
No, he's not.
I think what should really, really worry Wales is they got beaten by. Not the best Georgian team we've seen in, like then I don't they're not as good as the Gorgodza era Georgia. They're obviously very good, but there's been better Georgia teams, and to lose at home and put in a performance like that is massively concerning. Obviously this has led to people saying Pivac out and stuff.
Pivac out.
You know, JB, that what's that phrase?
You can win everything with
fish
kids.
Rots, fish rots from the head down, and this is a lot of chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah.
In terms of the administration of Wales at the high level, so I don't think a new coach is going to make any real difference.
No,
when Gatland came in what was it 2007 after the 2007 World Cup when they lost to Fiji and stuff, when Gatland came in. He had a massive player pool and the regions were doing well, and you had a good coach could actually turn that round. This is very different.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things you have to look at for Wales is how many of the old guard they are just extending the careers of. They are trying to squeeze every minute of rugby out of these lads, whether it be Cuthbert North, we spoke about, Tipperick, Faletau and Lydiot last week. And then this week...
Ken Owens, Priestland.
Yeah. And then this week, they've gone the other way around. So you know what Georgia are bringing. You'd have to be absolutely nuts to not think Georgia are going to come, try and scrummage us off the park, be physical, beat us up. You know that's coming. But with that, they've picked a second row who's 24. They've picked his replacement on the bench that's 19. They've mobilised Bradley Roberts from Ulster, who's like, what, the third choice there? You know.
Yeah.
So they've taken Georgia seriously to a degree, but this certainly isn't a first-choice Wales, and they just got exactly what they deserve. Josh McLeod, a lad who's never been capped, was brought back in after what a 4-year hiatus from the Welsh training squad for his first start. It's just not going to cut it, is it? And you know exactly what happened. Well, they just deserved what they got,
and Georgia deserved what they got.
Yeah,
so everyone can leave this game happy,
contented,
content. Yeah.
So some of the reactions to this Welsh loss are frankly startling. So I think the most common reaction is that the, well, as Roy Keane would call them, the prawn sandwich brigade, but as other people like to call them, the people with the padded seats and name tags are ruining Welsh rugby. And there was some debate a few weeks ago about, you know, Welsh rugby should be run by professionals. I'm not sure that is actually a good idea. Like, I don't think, you look around the world and you look at the sports administrators that find themselves in positions of power in rugby, do you have full confidence in them? And one of the biggest criticisms of the administrative state of rugby is that these people are not rugby people. They don't understand the sport. They've never played. They've never been part of a club. Wales have seems to have the opposite problem, which is we've got four guys who are rugby through and through. One's an ex-teacher. One's an ex coal mining manager, one is something else, you know, four of them. And I don't know what the right solution is. I can't imagine getting some person from, I don't know, some sort of, you can imagine the sort of CVs that you receive and their past experience of the people that they want to run Wales. And I just don't think it's necessarily going to work. I don't think I've heard of a decent sports administrator for a long, long time.
Well, whatever happens in Wales, they've got 10 months now.
Yeah.
But they can maybe get enough together out of the old gang and a few of the younger guys, the best younger guys, to be competitive in a few of the games. Well, but they're not going to be. Last time they were narrowly beaten in the semi-final by the world champions.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like that's going to happen again.
No. Well, that loss in itself was quite unusual for me. I mean, I didn't think they were good enough to get as far as they did, and they did. So, you know, you don't know how it's going to pan out. One thing you can be sure of is that they can't turn around the regional ship anytime soon.
No. That is heading in one direction.
Yeah, so I think Scarlets lost to Connacht this weekend. That's an amazing start that of the last, say, 30-odd games, the Welsh have only won four of them. I can't remember the exact stat, but it really puts into contrast the efforts of the Irish provinces compared to Wales provinces. And they're trying everything in their power. They're trying to threaten players with the 60 cap rule or the market rate deals, all of this stuff. It just seems to be failing. At every single hurdle, it seems to be failing. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, they're not spreading the game of rugby. They're not growing it. They feel like they've got all of the worst, features of the English game, particularly around lockdown. I mean, Welsh rugby during lockdown was an absolute disgrace. They, you know, bent the knee to the Welsh government when the Welsh government told them to watch their games over the Christmas period indoors. So you had these scenes where you could have players on the field, but all the fans had to watch from the clubhouse because they weren't allowed to stand by the playing field. You've got all of these things, and I don't think Wales has recovered or will recover from the effects of lockdown and the fact that, you know, the WRU weren't there to protect the sport when they absolutely needed to. And now they're going to pay. And now they're going to pay the price for it. And no one will hold their feet to the fire.
No, because there is no one to hold their feet to the fire.
No.
So it'd be a tough time to be a Wales fan. I'm sorry for you, JB. Feel sorry for you being a Wales fan in the run-up to a World Cup.
I'm absolutely fine with it.
Got an email here from Martin Lewis. contact.tedchasers@gmail.com. Hi, guys. Love the pod, blah, blah, blah. I just wanted to say, when people listen to the inevitable shift the blame to the Welsh pro clubs, can I point out that due to the mismanagement by the WRU, they still don't know their budgets for this current season, let alone next season. To then criticise the lack of talent being produced is madness. Could any pro team run an academy and pro team in the Premiership in this fashion? Now imagine trying to do so in a league with no salary cap. The current Welsh rugby The current, I think he's saying, the current issues in Welsh rugby stems of the lack of governance suitable for a professional era and self-serving committee men and old club tie and blazers who fear losing the cartel-like grip on power and the gravy train perks it brings. They're getting exactly what they deserve. So, sorry for the rant.
I heard a rumour the other day, and it goes something like this, that when the Wales guys are away in camp, the regions are still trying to train, but they can't put out a full team for team runs. So they're doing things like putting the S&C coach on the wing and, you know, going to the academy and getting a few of their boys to fill in at centre or prop or whatever it may be. I don't know if that is entirely true or if that is a common practice, but it certainly sounds pretty dire. What I don't get is, I just don't believe that the administrators in Wales are actually this bad or this incompetent or actually want what is occurring. I mean,
if that's just a fact, because saying how competent they are or not is a subjective thing. But if we're just putting some flesh on the bones and saying the regions do not have a budget for this season,
that is ridiculous. If that is the case,
I don't know if that's true or not. I have no idea how the finances of Welsh rugby work.
No.
Well, if that is true, then I think if that is true, or even saying they don't know what their budget is for next season, if they don't know what constraints they're operating within right now, that would be a factual, objective measure of utter incompetence.
Yes, I think you've made a strong point there.
You can definitely agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they got what they deserve, and I quite enjoyed watching it.
That's interesting. So one thing I did notice, there were quite a lot of England fans. I got the sense, particularly when England were 25-6 down, and I wonder if it was the same with Wales after the final whistle. Quite a few England fans, I think, were almost disappointed that England had a comeback because they thought if we got hammered, then Eddie might get binned.
Yeah, I was thinking this.
Yeah. I do think it would be possible. I think it would have to be a hell of a hammering. I think it would have to completely fall apart. But it's not impossible to see it.
I think your loss to Argentina would be the one where they pulled the trigger. I mean, if you compound that loss, who did they beat last week? Japan. Yeah, it doesn't really count. Yeah, a good hiding in this one would put some pressure on Eddie. He's not going anywhere.
He's not going anywhere.
Bill Sweeney.
And North Greenback, do you know what?
Go on.
Do you know what I was going to say, just while we're finishing off on Wales, what I don't understand, Wayne Pivac, do you remember how his team played at Scarlets? This real attacking brand of rugby.
Beautiful.
And that's what everyone was excited about when they came in, because that seemed to suit the personnel that Wales had, and all these back three and all these quick back rowers, like playing a slightly looser, more expansive game was going to suit them. And he came in and started like that. But to see them playing Georgia and kicking as much as they did and playing into Georgia's hands just smacks of absolute desperation and no plan, or at least the wrong plan.
Yeah. Yeah, a total lack. Well, yeah, either a total lack of a plan or it is definitely the wrong plan. They've identified a plan, kick loads to Georgia and try and match them physically is not the right plan if that was the plan.
Oh, well, never mind.
Speaking of things going badly.
Yes.
Australia have lost again.
Who did they lose to this week? Ireland.
So they've lost three games in 3 weeks. They've lost by, I think it's a total of 6 points or 5 points.
Yeah.
They've lost all of them narrowly. They lost by 1 point to Italy. Was it 1 point to France? And then 3 points to Ireland with an amazing last-minute kick from Ross Byrne from...
Was it Ross Byrne? I thought it was the other guy from Connacht.
He was off by that point.
Crowley's from Munster.
Yeah, him.
Not Jack Carty.
He started the season as the third choice Munster fly half.
And did you see the shirt he was wearing?
Yeah.
He's wearing
Sexton's actual shirt.
Yeah, the embroidered Johnny Sexton, 110 caps.
Why was that?
Because Sexton pulled out in the warm-up.
Oh, we see.
So there's question marks over the fitness, Johnny Sexton's fitness in the week. He then looked like he was going to make it, or he was going to make it, and then got injured in the warm-up, so Jack Crowley had
to. That's a proper collector's item, that, isn't it?
I was thinking, I wonder if Sexton will want that shirt or if he'll let Jack Crowley have it.
So why does Jack Crowley start and not Ross Byrne.
Ross Byrne.
Oh, he's the next man up.
Yeah, Ross Byrne. Ross Byrne actually only got called.
Ross Byrne came onto the bench. He was out. Yeah.
Yeah, he only got called into the wider squad.
Where was Ross Byrne in all this? Was he at hospitality having a beer?
No, not quite. So, he was only called into the wider squad. I think earlier this week when Sexton looked like he wasn't going to make it, and then he was presumably a travelling reserve because of Sexton's knock, but didn't think he was actually playing. And then with 3 minutes to go, slotted an amazing penalty to win the game.
Oh, good lad.
I do think it's interesting and quite, and when you dovetail it back to the discussion about the end of the game with England, it's interesting that the way you framed it, and you're absolutely right, Phil, you said Australia lost again. And they had a crack because it wasn't the last minute kick, was it, from Ross Byrne? There was a few minutes left and Australia won themselves a penalty in a kickable position and went for the corner. And here we are saying, oh, another defeat for Australia. They went for it and it didn't work. And maybe when you piece that together, maybe you kind of understand, even if you don't agree with it, even if you were in the stadium, you sort of understand why England did what they did, because all of those good things we're talking about in the last 8 minutes of attack would have been not the headline, and the headline would have been they lost again.
Yeah, lost two out of three so far. So yeah, that is a good point. And I kind of, I say it a little bit in jest about Australia. I mean, I'm not joking, they have lost three out of three games.
That's factually correct, yeah?
That is definitely factually correct. But I do think this Australia team is actually getting a lot out of this year, even if the results aren't all great. Like the combinations of players and the breadth and depth of the players that they are trying, getting experience in this, is quite remarkable, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Who wants to have a go at pronouncing that new fella's name?
Nope.
Wait, I did look this up because his Wikipedia page has a phonetic pronunciation of it. Give me 1 second. Pronounced, here we go. Pronounced Nawanga Nita Waze. Nawanga Nita Waze.
Nawanga Nita Waze.
Mark Nawanga Nita Waze.
Well done.
There you go.
Yeah.
6'4", 100 kg.
He looks all right, doesn't he? He pops up all over
is
the
shop. Is he an ex-NRL guy, by any chance?
He's not, interestingly. He's Fijian heritage, Fijian family. But as far as I'm aware, he's not played any NRL.
Ah. So, yeah, I agree with you, actually, Phil. I think the amount of experience that these guys are getting, by the time it's the World Cup, I think they're going to be a very exciting team, Australia. Very dangerous. They can score against anyone.
They can.
They've got some of the world's best players in there. Like, Will Skelton is an absolute outstanding player. They can play in different ways as well. When Michael Hooper went down, they changed their game completely to this sort of scavenging back row style to a carrying back row style. I think that's how I like them more. I like them when they're more aggressive and more on the front foot. Nick White does good things. I like Ikitau. I love Tom Wright. I think Tom Wright is an absolute superstar.
You know, Ty is great. Yeah, you're right. They've got loads of really good players. And you're right to point out how aggressive they were, because they've got that flair and that they can play ball when they want to. But Andy Farrell in his post-match chat was very at pains to point out that they made life very tough.
Yeah. Ireland, on the other hand, how many wins is that?
3 from 3.
Not bad.
And 11 at home in a row, is it? Equaling an all-time record, Irish record.
They are going to have one hell of a tussle in the spring.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
With France.
They are, those are the two best teams.
Yeah.
And they were Six Nations just gone. They were the two best teams by a distance as well. They were considered the only real game that each of them had was against each other, and France came out on top.
I do think France will bang them. Absolutely bang them. It's weird. I see the world of rugby at the moment being consisted of effectively two or three very good teams, one good team, and everyone else is sort of in the mix, average.
So the best two teams are France and Ireland, I think.
I think, put Ireland in a separate group underneath them with South Africa.
See, I'd put New Zealand ahead of South Africa.
I don't know about that.
So New Zealand won the rugby championship, beat South Africa in South Africa, although they also lost to South Africa in South Africa.
Yeah.
I just think New Zealand are a little bit better than South Africa, but not by much.
Yeah, I think Ireland, New Zealand, South Africa are all much of a muchness. France are top of the tree, and then there's this huge group of other countries, and it's just hard to separate them. I think Scotland can play good rugby, England can play good rugby, Wales can win or lose on any given day.
Wales can mix it and beat most teams. Like Wales can and have this season beat
Australia in South Africa. Japan are probably in that group.
Japan and close to, yeah, they're not far off that group.
So they could be like, but this is why the way that the pools have fallen in the World Cup is so crucial. And yes, you're going to have to beat the best teams to become a world champion, but if it all goes to form and the teams you expect to get out of the pools get out of the pools, it is going to be Ireland playing South Africa or France, and Ireland and New Zealand playing South Africa or France. Or if I got that right. No. Ireland or South Africa playing New Zealand or France.
Yeah. It's going to be good.
In the quarterfinals.
Whichever way it goes.
It's going to be good, but two of the four best teams are gone at the semi-final stage.
Hmm. So does that all... Is this one of those where you're... Oh, I guess it's... Yeah, New Zealand, France, and Ireland and South Africa. That is interesting. A and B,
so
A and
England,
B.
England, if they, assuming we get out of the pool, touch wood, I'm taking nothing for granted, but if we get out of the pool, we will face Wales or Australia or Fiji, you would imagine.
Or Fiji.
So, yeah, so I'm just looking at it here. So England's pool in Pool D. So if you win Pool D, you'll play runner-up in Pool C, which will be either Wales, Australia or Fiji, or possibly Georgia. But it's one of those. So you play the second best team of Wales, Australia, Fiji. Then if you win that, it's the winner of Pool A versus the runner-up of Pool B. So you could, this is where it gets, because of the cross-contamination, you could end up playing New Zealand or South Africa or Ireland or France. It could be any
one of those. Yeah, you'll play one of those in a semi-final, but the point is you get to the semi-final, and at that point,
you've got a good chance.
You can raise yourself for a game. You've got a decent chance.
Yeah.
But Ireland and New Zealand and South Africa and France are going to face each other in the quarterfinals, which is rough.
Yes, that is the problem, isn't it, for them?
So
for them, it's their problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Glad it's not our problem.
Exactly. Well, let's get out of our group first, because
quite right.
We lose to Argentina again. It looks a bit dicey.
Yeah. So meanwhile, the unstoppable South Africa, who were stopped last week, actually, restart another unbeaten run.
After losing two games in a row.
Yep.
It might have even been more than that, because they lost to. Oh, no, because they won the last game was against last two games against Argentina.
Well, they won this weekend, 21-63.
Did you see this game?
I saw bits of it.
So I watched all of this.
Bloody hell.
The first...
Wow, that's commitment, Phil. Well played.
Well, the first half was excellent, and it was an excellent performance by Italy in the first half. It was... I can't remember what the exact score was, but it was something like 14-18 at half-time, and Italy were right in it. They put pressure on South Africa.
13-16 is what it was at half-time.
13-16. Capuoso, the little rugby pixie, nipped over for another nice try.
He is fast, isn't he?
He is. A little live wire. A little coming around the back. A little bit like the Manu line that he made a good break off, Marcus Smith. But almost more surprising hands from the man inside him. So I thought it was really good first half. But then South Africa changed it up a bit. They brought this...
Well, can I just read you the South Africa bench? This is the most startling thing to me. South Africa bench consisted of Malcolm Mark, Stephen Kitsoff, Vincent Cock, Eben Etzebeth, Quagga Smith, Evan Roos. Best of luck, boys.
Well, and obviously, those boys, when they came on, made a difference. I'll tell you the guy that made most difference.
Kobus Reinach?
Nope.
Manny Libok?
Libok. Yeah, fly half.
Don't know him. Who is he?
So he plays for the Stormers, used to play for the Sharks and the Bulls. He's a bit of a live wire fly half. I don't know much about him, but he looked good. And they put because Colby got injured, so they put Willemse on the wing.
Ah, I love that.
And Libok and Willy LaRue were kind of pulling the strings.
Ah.
And it worked. Now, how much of it was Libok coming in and playing with a bit of freedom? How much of it was the fact that the bomb squad, I know you hate the term the bomb squad, but
awful.
It's what everyone calls them, that bench, that forward bench, which is must be one of the best ever forward benches.
It's not bad.
Coming off against an already exhausted Italy team just completely marmalised them.
Yep. Where does the bomb squad... I'm trying to understand the meaning of that. If it was...
They defuse the situation
if on the bench you had like a couple of rapid wingers and a fly half that kicked the ball miles in the air,
yeah,
would kick that bomb squad, that would make sense.
Freddie Stewart, Israel Folau, and somebody else. Yeah.
That's a bomb squad.
Completely agree.
I don't understand the bomb... I don't even understand the term, where it came from and why.
So they come on and defuse the situation. I just think it's a terrible term.
It is a terrible term, but we're stuck with it now.
Yeah,
it's better than system players or whatever. Is that Pat Lamb's one at Bristol?
Yeah, it's not as good as concussion boys, though, is it?
Noticed that Gareth Southgate started using the phrase finishers for his bench?
Has he?
Have you noticed that they've been banned from
wearing another reason not to watch the Football World Cup?
They've been banned from wearing their rainbows in Qatar.
Banned from having a beer in the ground.
That's ridiculous, isn't it? I do kind of like the Qatari way of saying, yeah, we've changed our mind now, boys.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it? Oh, you're going to do nothing? Okay, brilliant. Crack on.
Budweiser might do something, but...
Good luck. What are they going to do? Take them to Qatari court?
Honestly, I'm not remotely interested in this Football World Cup. I'd be vaguely interested if it was somewhere else, but just the whole thing is just ridiculous.
What don't you like about it, Tim?
Well, I think you're nothing without principles. If the Rugby World Cup was in Dubai, to draw this back to rugby, I have a massive issue with rugby talking about, like, no, it's not that rugby, I have no issue with stuff happening in Dubai. I have a massive issue with LGBT and everything being such a prominent thing, which I have no problem with in rugby. I've got no problem with that on its own. I don't care if you do your rainbow laces. I'm happy with all of that. But then if you have a big, lucrative sevens tournament in a country where it's illegal to be gay and people get killed and thrown off buildings, then I kind of think that's slightly hypocritical and maybe you're just...
It's the hypocrisy of the individuals involved, isn't it, which is upsetting.
Yes.
So, you know, like Gary Neville working for the Qataris. But actually, I quite like the Gary Neville stance on the World Cup, which is it is a World Cup and, you know, it has to go to countries across the world. Gary Lineker was saying the reason he hates it so much is because it was bought. And I think that's a far better argument than they don't believe in XYZ or their laws are barbaric or
yeah, I would like a little bit more honesty rather than the like, what was it, that Alex Scott woman I read that she'd said today on the telly, not going, I don't agree with it, but not going would be the easy choice. It's far more
the easy choice
come here. And it's like, no, the easy choice is to take all that cash. But
of course it is.
Own that and be honest about it. Just say, like you say, Gary Neville going, or whatever, it's a World Cup. I want to work on the World Cup. I don't like where it is, but I want to work on the World Cup. Problem is, you get hoisted by your own petard when you make such a virtue of how you're against XYZ and you're standing for it, which, again, I have no problem with. That's fine. I'm there with you. But then you look like a hypocrite.
I mean, I do like the idea of, like, first time of it being in a Muslim country, first time of it being in the Middle East. I think that's pretty cool. Yeah, I think it's quite cool when sporting events show up in places that you do not expect. So I would suspect that something like the Rumble in the Jungle, Muhammad Ali, would have been one of the most epic spectacles of all time. Of all time. Because it was never meant to be there. So that's how I feel about this.
Yeah, I get that. But Phil works in construction. I guess with the differences, like with the Everton Stadium, Phil, which your company is working on, there aren't any migrant slave labour dying from being overworked and then just being chucked in with the concrete in the foundations.
Definitely not.
Why?
Would it pass the health and safety audit?
No, that side of things is pretty shocking. And just the fact that, so I always remember back to a conversation that we had in an izakaya in Tokyo.
Yeah.
With certain individuals within World Rugby, and they were saying that one of the problems with a tournament like the Rugby World Cup is you have an influx of people, of paying customers, visitors, guests, fans, to the tune of somewhere between 400 and 500,000
yes.
people coming into the country. So certain countries that are not
particularly
Ireland
can't deal with that.
Yeah, Ireland don't have the hotels to deal with that.
Or the infrastructure, or the stadium, or the roads, or anything.
Yeah. Whereas a country like Japan, that's 130,000 people, like we were in...
130,000?
Sorry, 130 million people. So it's a fraction of a percent of the population.
Tokyo...
The greater Tokyo area, what was it you told me, is the same size as Northern Ireland?
Oh, it's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And in population...
It's beautiful as well. It's
population,
an incredible place.
Oh, no, in population it's much more, but just in terms of the whole hinterland of the whole greater Tokyo area is the same landmass as all of Northern Ireland.
It doesn't spread. It's like 2 hours to get across it by their fantastic transport network.
It's such a marvel of the modern world.
But it's probably... I would guess it's something in the region of 50 to 100 times the population of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
It's that magnitude. It's absolutely enormous. And so, anyway, my point being, Rugby World Cup is expecting, let's just call it 500,000 to make it round numbers. 6 months ago, Qatar only had 30,000 hotel rooms. Even now, even with all they're parking up cruise ships, they've...
you've seen the fan camps.
The egg chasers. Yeah, the egg chasers shipping container. Egg chasers shipping container is much more luxurious than the fan camps.
We're getting 300 quid a night for people staying in our shipping container.
Amazing.
Then even with all of that, I think it's only 100,000 people. And so people are going to have to be travelling in by day via, well, and you're limited as to where you can travel in from because of all the politics in the region.
Yeah.
So it's...
I just go to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Jerusalem. Get a taxi.
So there's all of that side which just make it look like a ludicrous decision, which it was, because it was clearly just a corrupt... It's just all about the money. So if you are holding it in, I guess, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, or in somewhere like Saudi... You'd still disagree with the politics, but they are at least big enough countries to actually have the infrastructure to support it. It just seems so crackers.
Have you heard Giovanni Infantino?
Infantino. Yeah. Oh my word! That statement he made is. I read what he'd said. And I thought.
I tried to sing it last night.
Is this a parody Twitter account I'm looking at here? What?
I tried to sing it to the tune of R. Kelly. I am a whatever it is.
Oh my
unbelievable.
God.
Yeah, I can't stand the grandstanding. Do you know what? I'll recommend you to a podcast. There was a Rest Is History podcast with Gary Lineker on it, and he goes through how they went for the bids and how he showed up to the bidding process and how it was bought and paid for. And also Gary Lineker's got his own political views, which are somewhat extreme. And it's just really interesting, like, how the politics of the World Cup pan out. His point of view on it, and his trip to the Kremlin when he got to meet Vladimir Putin, but turned him down.
Mm.
Do I think, actually, he's got to be a feather in your cap? I mean, I would not turn him down. I'd go meet him.
Would you?
100% I'd meet him. I mean, I'm not travelling to that. I'm not travelling east ever. And Dubai doesn't count.
I was going to say, having pointed out your own hypocrisy, east, JB,
it's
making a big virtue of how you won't travel east, but then you'll go into Dubai.
Eastern Europe is very different to Dubai. Believe you me. I might go to Turkey one day. I think Turkey would be
Any particular reason why you'd go to Turkey?
I just think it'd be. I think Istanbul would be fascinating. I'd love to visit.
Istanbul, the cornerstone of like the old world, yeah. New world. Like,
I'd love to visit
the old Silk Road,
the docks and the port of Istanbul. Which sounds weird, but when you fly over it, it is so enormous.
Mm.
It is so enormous.
Yeah,
you're right, Phil. The history there in that area is just unreal. Like you say, the Silk Road and the conquest that there were, the Mongols coming from the east and. Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing place.
And the Ottoman Empire as well, more recently. Yeah. Like, yeah.
And the what's his thingy the Great? What's his name? Who came from the Macedonians?
Peter the Great.
No, what's Alexander the Great. Name? Oh. Alexander the Great. Thank you.
Mm.
So that whole area, so much cool stuff. No. It's not cool. It's just cool to learn about it. It must have been absolutely horrendous being in that part of the world at that time.
Yes. Completely agree. Couldn't agree more.
Where were we? Oh, yeah, we're talking about Italy.
What I was going to suggest is as we took that little detour, why don't we just take a little stop off at Portugal?
Yes, making it to well the remembered.
Poor AJ McGinty. But congratulations to Portugal.
Yeah, so I've not seen any of this, but as I understand it, it was a last-minute penalty that put Portugal level, and they drew this game. And there's a few people I've seen saying, well, did it not go to like golden point or extra time or anything like that? But of course it didn't, because even though this was effectively a knockout, this was a table. There's round robin, so there's three games, four teams, and so Portugal win on points difference.
Yeah, delighted. Oh. Delighted for them.
Did they win comfortably on points difference or was it close?
No, it was 18-all. Oh, sorry, I see what you're saying, yes.
Yeah, they put in the table. 85 points on whoever they played last week. Was it Kenya last week? They put 85 points on.
Draws are so rare in rugby. We talked about whether England should have gone for the win or maybe might have lost it. And as you said rightly, Phil, there was nothing ultimately riding on it. But this two draws in a weekend or in a few days, and one of them being the most significant that there's been.
Yeah, the points difference. So United States were plus 133 and for 133 and against 37. And Portugal
plus 96.
96, yeah. And Portugal were plus 143. So 10 points more and against 30. So 7 points fewer. So they had a 17-point cushion when they got the draw. But had the United States not conceded that 82nd-minute penalty, then they would have won.
Well, changing the guard. So
poor AJ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But very good for Portugal. And we finally will have a team in there who are not Spain.
Yes. An Iberian Peninsula team, not Spain.
Yeah, it's great news, I think. I think it's exactly what World Rugby needs.
Yes, yeah, agreed.
So what pool are Portugal in?
They go into Wales, Australia, Fiji, Georgia, I think, is the pool.
Cool.
Last game of the weekend, France versus Japan. Who saw it?
Yeah, saw most of it.
Awesome game.
Yeah.
France never really felt like they got out of kind of second or third gear. They played.
That's not the last game of the weekend, by the way. We haven't talked about Scotland.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the Fight Fest.
Yeah.
I think the main takeaway from Scotland, Argentina, before we move on to Sunday, is that. I didn't see what the TV post match interview was, but I heard what Gregor Townsend said to the Talk Sport reporter in his post match chat, and it appeared to me like Gregor Townsend was just stopping short of praising Finn Russell. He was like, he had a great game, didn't he? Is that the best you've seen him play in a Scottish shirt? Yeah, he had a good game. Of course, there was a lot of space left. Argentina left a lot of holes. They had players going off. It was kind of like that. Finn Russell played well, but Argentina helped him play well.
Through gritted teeth.
Was through gritted teeth. And he's in danger of looking very, very silly now, isn't he?
Well, anyone who drops Finn Russell is very silly. I just don't see a good argument for it. He's a generational talent. The only reason you would get rid of him is because it has to be an ego play. It just has to be an ego play. You can't legislate for what Finn Russell does. You can't coach it to anyone else. No one can replace him. So you've just got to sort of suck it up and play him.
I did see an argument this week. I can't remember who it was, but in our Egg Chasers North Dorset Sevens WhatsApp group, mm-hmm. which was basically, I thought it was a very good point. So making the point that because Finn Russell is so unique, if he is injured, if he's unavailable for a reason...
Isn't this my argument about Finn Russell?
Well, you've just said there is no reason why you drop him.
The unique talent argument.
So this argument does make sense. And if you agree with this, then I guess you disagree with yourself from 30 seconds ago.
Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible.
But because he's so unique, you can never replace him. So you need someone else to have some experience of doing something else that is not Finn Russell.
The Sam James paradox.
Yeah, I guess Finn Russell is an even sharper example of the Sam James paradox.
Yes, yes.
So he was definitely out of the first game because he was unavailable, because Scotland played their first game...
Outside the window,
so he wasn't available. But then he was brought in for the... Was he brought in for the second game, or did he only come in for the New Zealand game? I can't actually remember.
No, I can't either. Oh, look, they had a handsome win over a very good team.
Yeah, he did only play the third. He started the third game because they gave Adam Hastings a shot in the second game.
Yeah. Can we talk about France now?
Yes, unless you've got any more points on Scotland.
Just to go, Argentina are in England's pool, and again, we saw what the can do at Twickenham, but they are a bizarre... They're just a bizarre team. Like, Michael Checker's done a really good job with them, but... A red card and three yellows. Weirdly, they actually scored that. They actually scored that a try. They look really good with 12 players.
Yeah, do you think Michael Checker's good with the Argentines because he's got Lebanese parents?
Well, he's good. He's used to playing or coaching 13 men on the pitch. So
yeah, well, there is that.
There's the crossover there. That Buffelli try was it? They were down to 12 men at that point, weren't they?
Carreras and set him up. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a lovely try. Buffelli is some player.
Yeah, isn't he? He's good.
He's a hell of a player.
Tell he's got some good players. Japan. Tell you what, two of their tries were beautiful.
They always score some nice tries.
God,
set-piece tries as well.
Yeah.
First phase tries that against France.
Yeah, that one in the right at the start of the second half.
Nawato Saito?
Saito.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful try. The line that they cut for that, I mean, I don't know where they'll end up in the World Cup and how many teams they'll beat, but they'll do something. They'll beat somebody.
I loved the last World Cup, obviously, because we were watching some of the games. We watched them beat Scotland and maybe Ireland in Japan with Japanese fans around us, and that was pretty special.
It was. France are just the best team on the planet. There's not really much other way to put it. I mean,
so I don't think they played that well today.
Yeah, they weren't at their best. They have not been at their best this autumn, and I think that's...
Oh, I don't know.
I think they're some way short of their best.
Yeah, they weren't best today because they're missing players. Obviously, Dupont makes a huge difference. I'm not convinced that Maxime Lucu is the replacement for him at all.
It was a very Dupont-esque run that scored the try.
Yeah, Baptiste Caloud? However you say his name, when he came on, he looked...
Kouliou.
That's an incredible pronunciation. I would never have got there.
Kouliou.
And I thought Jalibert, when he came off the bench, is really making a strong case for himself to start.
So that's
the chat in France. That is the big chat in France.
And that is an interesting point, because I thought Entomac has looked a bit static and stale. Now, I didn't know...
Hold on, you stop that right there. Untermack looks amazing. He's been playing a bit stale.
You are correct, Tim, of course. He looks fantastic. But, yeah, he has been. And I don't know how much of that is because I read just before the start of the tournament, just before I actually first saw him play, that he's hardly played for Toulouse this season because of injuries. And so, in my head, I've put two and two together. And I'm, of course, saying that he's been static and stale. I thought Jalibert looked great when he came on. A lot more spark than Entomac has given. I'll tell you who else was playing. He's been playing brilliantly. Ramos.
Yeah.
He looked so lively.
When he takes off, it is very impressive. He's a lot quicker than I give him credit for.
Yeah.
A lot quicker.
He's kicked excellently. He can step in as a second receiver at 10. He knows when to play as well. He knows when to kick because he's got a good boot, but... He's been looking good.
Dante's the interesting one for me. because he does a job. And they seem to be quite reliant on him going forward. Just his sheer strength and power is scary, actually. It's interesting because I think that Intermac for them is like talismanic. And if he's not playing particularly well at 10 and Jalibert is the boy, does Intermac then go into that Dante role? Because they're completely different players, totally different players. Dante is a typical French 12 who gets over the game line. Intermac is something more like an Anglo or an Aussie sort of. Yeah, 12, yeah.
He's more like an Aussie 12when he plays 12.
So they're completely different players. But it can work because Fiku is incredibly strong and direct too.
Yeah. That Dante and Fiku, people often forget just how big Fiku is because he plays on the wing. I think he's like 6'2 or 6'3 and 105 kilos.
Yeah, and he's pretty athletic with it too.
He's very athletic. He's a big boy figure. That centre partnership is very, very big.
Yeah. Well,
I just had to take my sort my headphones out. So apologies if you said it already. But speaking of big strong boys that played very, very well, Julien Marchand was awesome.
Marchand was awesome.
Oh,
Aldrich was awesome. Olivon. To me,
talking about people that look good. Oh my goodness me, he might be the best looking man on earth.
He's up there, isn't he?
Olivon has the look of a World Cup winning captain.
He's got a look of a film star.
He just looks magnificent. I can just see him lifting the trophy. He will look magnificent doing it.
Yeah, Marchand is great. I think Malvaca just brings violence and running combined to a new level.
Marchand's arms are so amazing. The guy is just enormous. I love the options they've got. I've got a lot of time for it. And like I say, I didn't think France were particularly good.
Yeah.
I think they've got a lot of improvement to make. And they've rounded off an unbeaten year. They've rounded off an unbeaten autumn. They could quite easily have lost the first two games.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think they've got now
very true.
This core of a team, quite a young team, but lads that just will not get dropped. So Aldrit seems to be an automatic starter to me. Fiku is an automatic starter. Pinot, who's going to replace Pinot? He's amazing.
Yeah, Pinot very handy. Dupont and Untermac are... Untermac's the one that could be dropped, but he probably won't be. Olivon and Jalonche and Aldrit forms a very handy back row.
Wauke has to play. He's another guy I love.
Yeah.
He's probably one of the best players on the planet at what he does.
And having the 6-2 split with Makalu is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has done interesting things off the bench, particularly on the wing. He's not too bad.
He's like the inverse of Jack Noll.
Inverse Jack Noll. Negative Jack Noll.
Negative Noll.
Yeah.
Makalu.
Yeah. He's more like a Ben Earl, if Eddie trusted Ben Earl to play on the wing occasionally.
Who was talking about Ben Earl playing rugby league this week? Someone was talking about that.
No, someone was talking about Tom Curry.
No, there was someone from rugby league said the two players they would take from Union to go and play league. I think Ben Earl was one of them. Is that what happened?
Maybe. I think
it might have been Ben Earl and Owen Farrell. I can't remember who.
No, it was Tom Curry. Definitely Tom Curry seems to ring.
Tom Curry, yes, it was Curry and was it Curry and Earl?
Yeah, I think it was. I'd love to see Tom Curry give the 13-man code a bash.
Mm.
He's an interesting, but I don't think he would do as well as Earl.
Tom Curry, it's the way he plays. There is no other player that gets his England kit as dirty as Tom Curry does.
The violence, mate.
He ends every game with a green kit.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a powerful bloke. I'll give him that much.
He is.
Frightening.
Very much so.
So next week we've got some more internationals. Oh,
so there's only two internationals next week.
Hang on a minute, boys. Just let's just calm down a bit. Premiership Cup this weekend.
Yeah, whatever.
Did Sale win?
Whatever. More important than that is how Marlow got on. How did they get on this week?
Well, as you well know, it's a fallow week for the domestic teams.
For the first team, but I'm so invested in Marlow. I want to know how their women, their second.
I think the women probably lost, as did the second team. That's what I think. I wouldn't be surprised if the under-16s went away today and lost as well.
You'd be pleased to know that Sean has messaged us.
Oh, yes.
And unfortunately, he says no first team for no first team game this weekend. Seconds lost and the ladies team lost. So the wheels have come off. However, the under 16s hosted
Ponty
Clun under 16s and had the
is
best
time. Is that a
made
up name?
I don't
know.
Could
well be.
Don't know.
Doesn't sound like tribute South North to me.
So what he says,
Ponty Clun.
What he says, we the under 16s hosted Ponty Clun and had the best time. He then says they won handsomely. They won handsomely. So Ponty Clun won handsomely, but the clubhouse was alive and the crack was brilliant. This is what local rugby is all about.
Very nice.
It was a touring team. Well, I do have it on authority that I know Marlow under 14s are considering a tour to Manchester because one of their former players moved to Chorlton and he plays at Raffy Quirk's Broughton Park.
Rudge match. Nice. Who is that player? Who is said player?
I'm not sure. I don't know. All I know is that Raffy Quirk's Broughton Park under 15s today won 43-10 against Heaton Moor.
Beat down.
Yep. At their place with their referee. I just, it happens sometimes when in the Lancashire Cup reverse fixture a few weeks ago, some of the parents and coaches on the Heaton Moor touchline were less than complimentary about the referee and felt they were hard done by in their Lancashire Cup defeat. As you can imagine, that added some fuel to the lads' motivations going out and playing tomorrow. And
went
two Heaton Moor and won 43-10.
Have you sorted out your training dramas yet with the pitch?
It's ongoing, JB. I'll just say that. All I'll say this, right? So there's one completely floodlit training pitch on a Wednesday night. There were 29 players on that, which were from three different age groups. So you can do the maths. They had about 12 or so players each. Meanwhile, on the half floodlit pitch, we had one third of it and we had 24 lads.
Oh, dear. Very congested, small-sided games, mate.
Yeah, but not great when you want to do a team run and work some moves and string some phases together for two reasons. One, you don't have the space, and two, you can't see the ball when you go.
Do you know why those pitches at the back of Broughton Park are so poor?
No idea.
Do you know, Phil? Do you know what history of Broughton Park is?
I don't know.
Well, that whole area around Broughton Park was actually an airfield for airships during the Second World War. So what they did is they levelled it, they put some rugby pitches on it and away you went. But every so often, things from underneath start getting pushed
their way up.
And we're talking like railway girders, actual rail line bricks. I mean, there were hangars there for massive airships. And that's what they flew out of.
You need a big hangar for an airship.
A very big hangar. A very large hangar.
I'm not surprised that you know this. One, because you played at Broughton Park, so you would take an interest in the history.
Exactly.
Secondly, because I'm sure you considered an airship business at some point, didn't you?
Airlander 10. Oh, what I couldn't tell you about Airlander 10.
Was that your cross Pennines?
Yes.
Plan.
You could get from Hough End on an Airlander.
South Manchester for anyone who obviously doesn't know where Hough End is.
To Sheffield, what's the shopping centre called? Meadowhall,
yeah.
In about 10 minutes.
Well, now that the Mottram bypass has been approved.
Has it?
Thank you, Robert Largan MP. You'll be there in under 10 minutes.
Really?
No, not really.
I was going to say.
You'll be there. At the moment, it's an awful, awful journey across the Snake Pass or Woodhead Pass.
Isn't that absolute disgrace, actually?
For like a 40-mile journey, it's an absolute
between
disgrace.
Two major UK cities.
Yeah.
Do you want to...
It's bonkers, isn't it?
Which is the shortest motorway in the UK?
M65?
Oh, it's...
Wrong!
Oh, no, there's an A road. I know there's a road on the Manchester flyover bit. There's a little bit of road that they were going to build and then they stopped.
M67.
I was going to say M67 being the other one. You work your way up M65, no. M66, no. M67, yes.
M67 is what, like, I think it's like 8 kilometres?
Yeah, it's tiny. Yeah. Just from, M60 to kind of Mottram around there.
The only disappointing thing about if the journey across the Pennines is changed is there's that brilliant house in the middle of the M62.
Yeah,
to Leeds, between Manchester and Leeds. There's that one bloke who refused to move.
So
would not take
isn't it?
The sort of the land purchase order on his house. He went, I'm not moving anywhere. So they built the road around him.
So I have heard that was the old story I always used to get told when I was a kid, going over the Pennines. I've also heard that that is not actually the true story.
Oh really?
That the land.
I'll just stop you at this point and say, please, if you're listening right now and you've got no idea what I'm talking about, just Google house between Manchester and Leeds on the M62 and get a picture of it so you can get the full effect of Phil's story. Go on, Phil.
Yeah, well, it is. It's the highest, around there, it is the highest motorway in England as well. So you're at the top of the Pennines and it's a house jammed in the middle. The motorway splits and the eastbound lane is on the north side and the westbound lane is on the south side of this house, and there's a little bridge under, sorry, a little tunnel under the motorway.
It's called Slot Hall Farm, Phil.
Is it? Slot Hall Farm. I've heard, and I don't know how true this is.
Slot Hall Farm.
I don't know how true this is, but I've heard that they never actually made an offer to him because the lie of the land and the conditions of the land for his little farm is unsuitable, so they were always gonna, the best thing, the simplest and cheapest thing was always to split the motorway in that section and have kind of the higher and lower bands, the north and the eastbound and westbound
side. Wow.
But I don't know how true that is. I'm sure someone will write to us, contact headchasers@gmail.com to tell us.
I'm looking at an article from February of this year. These local newspaper websites are dreadful. The amount of adverts and stuff they chuck up at you. Farmer Paul Thorpe has told what it's like to live in the middle of the M62, why it's in the middle of the motorway, and the stubborn farmer myth. So I think you are right, Phil.
Interesting.
So let's move on from this. Sail Sharks.
Yeah.
Premiership Cup.
I don't care.
Well,
does anybody care?
Yes, of course. Ryan Mills cares because he's been signed by Sale.
There's been a few more bits of business, isn't there?
Yeah, so it's not so much that we care about the Premiership Cup. Of course, we do care about the Premiership Cup. But it's the arrival of so many new players. So this week, Bath have signed Alfie Barbary.
Yeah.
Sale have signed Ryan Mills. Looks like Jack Willis.
Sorry, who signed Barbary?
Bath, long-term deal.
Yeah.
Oh my word. That's exciting.
They just need to keep him fit.
Although, yeah, I was going to say, Bath is the one club that has really consistently bad injury.
Don't worry about it. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll just be fine. Who's the other one?
The Willeye are going to Toulouse.
And Bordeaux, respectively.
Or Bordeaux, yeah.
Yep.
Is it Bordeaux? So are they not both going to the same one?
No,
no.
Tom is going to Bordeaux. Jack is going to Toulouse.
Will I head to head in a top 14 clash next season? That's going to be fun to watch.
It will.
That does also present a bit of a dilemma because Jack is obviously in the England squad at the moment, but he will be playing in France for. I don't actually know the length of the deal, but he will be playing in France immediately up to England going to a World Cup. And obviously, Zach Mercer is having to come home, as Chris Ashton's done previously, as others have done as well.
Not really fair, is it?
It's if he's able to play for Toulouse. Now, it does depend on how they invoke the rule, because there's always been this exceptional circumstances rule, but it's never been, I don't believe...
Never been successfully used, no.
It's never been used. So, this could set a precedent that Zach Mercer... going to play for lots and lots of money in Montpellier and also getting out of Bath is not an exceptional circumstance. However, a club going into administration and a load of players becoming
You do feel, though, don't you,
redundant.
If exceptional circumstances were going to be invoked, it'd be for the Saracens boys who ended up in France last year after the relegation. So, like, Lazoski. I mean, Lazoski's not played for England for a long time.
Yeah.
But you'd have thought that would be one.
But there was no one... So there was no one.
And the champion, the championship, did that count? Or did they just change the rules?
But they've just got to be playing in England. Yeah. They've never had
I really hope this is the accidental dismantling of the whole concept.
Yep, completely agree. If it all goes, I think it's terrible. Okay. So, yeah, Ryan Mills, Sign for Sale, is a hell of a bit of business.
Again, I would have the Barbary caveat.
They were in for...
he hardly played for Wasps since he's been at, when he was at Wasps.
Yeah, so they were in...
He's hardly played for about 5 years.
Oh, mind you, played he at Wasps last year as well. No, he moved from Worcester last year.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he's hardly played. So
they're in for two players, Berger Odendel.
That's the boy I would have got.
Yeah, he was about to move to Sale. They went, no, we want you.
Ryan Mills. Because you're half the price.
Well, I mean, price might have paid a part in it, but he's big.
That's it. There you go. That's the Manu Tuilagi tax right there.
Yeah.
They've got Manu, so they had to go for Ryan Mills instead of Berger Odendahl.
And who else played for Sale this weekend?
Woodward.
Correct. Jason Woodward also played. Mm. And they won by about 1 million points.
Now, did you see the try scorers for the Barbarians against Bath?
No.
Unattached players.
Okay,
was Marlon Yard one of them?
Marlon Yard was not one of them. No.
So it was like Robson and...
No, Robson's gone to... Robson's gone to either Perpignan or Pau. Perpignan, I think.
Hoo-haw?
No, but he was playing.
Is he not unattached?
He might be unattached, but he was playing, but he didn't score a try.
Tom Cruise.
What website can I look at to find Elliot the Stuke results of this? I've just looked at BBC, and like they have, I've got all of the women's Allianz Premier 15s.
Wonderful.
I've got all of National 1. I've got no Barbarians v Bath.
I'll tell you, so JB uses the terrible...
Mike Brown.
Ultimate Rugby app.
Marco Manfredi. Luther Burrell.
The app that I've started using is Tribe, which is quite good.
Is that an Exeter-based one?
I've heard someone else say this.
It's not, but it's...
I've heard someone else mention this. It's really good. I've had it recommended to me. I can't remember who said it. It was...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you reminded me of that.
It's not bad. It's not bad. So you can set up... Here's my Tribe homepage, JB. So these are all the...
Wow, look at that.
All the leagues I'm following. Premier Rugby, Ultimate Rugby Championship, International Rugby. I've got... In 292 days' time, the first Rugby World Cup in France 23 kicks off. I've got Top 14, Champions Cup, Challenge Cup, Women's Rugby World Cup, the Rugby League World Cup, and then Cricket, Premier League, Super Rugby, Super Rugby Pacific. I've got everything.
Wow, really impressive.
So yeah, it's not bad. The only thing it doesn't do is it doesn't give you player details. So you'd have to go separately to
Remember,
look up the players.
We used to have a sponsor called Sports Lobster. Whatever happened to Sports Lobster?
Good question.
Yeah, isn't
But the two unattached...
Didn't sponsor us enough.
Yeah, exactly yes. right.
The two unattached try scorers who both got a double were Big Luth and Mike Brown.
Wow.
They both got doubles, and a last minute, an 81st minute Damian McKenzie drop goal won it for the Barbars.
Apparently McKenzie was outstanding again.
Damian McKenzie is a ridiculous, exceptional talent. If he was playing for any other nation on earth, except maybe France, he'd be playing.
I agree with you, mate. I totally agree. Any other games next week? Is Premiership Cup final, mate? Maybe?
No, there's Premiership.
Actual Premiership?
Actual, real, live, bona fide Gallagher with, English Premiership.
Tell me about the Premiership.
With Welsh players back in the mix, with Scottish players back in... Oh, no, Wales play Australia, but the Welsh Premiership players will be back playing for the Premiership, won't they? Yep.
And, crucially, the South African players will be back. Not that there's a huge number playing in the Premiership, but...
Oh, yeah, that does take the shine off England v South Africa a little bit, doesn't it?
It does. But the... So, we'll do Premiership first, then we'll do the couple of internationals. So, we've got... on Friday night, Harlequins host Gloucester.
Give me...
Quins.
Harlequins.
And I think that'll be quite comfortable. And Falcons host Chiefs. They're
a horrible place to go on a Friday night.
Yeah, but Chiefs are a horrible team. They'll be fine.
Well, great for the beers afterwards on Friday. But other than that, tough.
Oh, I forgot about the Wales players being back and available now because I was Christian's. Is he injured? I dropped him from my fantasy rugby draft thing, which I was cursing.
Either way, David Jenkins is available.
Yes.
But he's not Christian's, or is he?
No, he's not. The beatdown of all beatdowns will be occurring at the AJ Bell on Sunday 27th.
Sunday 27th?
Is a week after.
Saturday.
Saturday. Are you on Ultimate
I think it's
Rugby
a live. I think
again?
It's a live game on BT Sports, Sale v Bristol.
At 1 o'clock on
I've got it
at 1
o'clock
Saturday.
Sunday.
Are you on Ultimate Rugby app?
Guilty.
JB, why do you do this every single week?
Yeah, there seems to be no Saturday games according to Ultimate Rugby. Brilliant.
So, Saturday, Sale host Bristol at the AJ Bell, 1 o'clock.
Absolute beatdown. Bristol will get precisely zero change out of Sale. Precisely.
Yeah, give me Sale.
Yeah. Absolute embarrassment.
Yeah, the Sale will win. And that is the precursor for the two international games as well. But we'll get into that in a minute because the Sunday games, Leicester Tigers v London Irish. Possibly the Hassel Collins Bowl in the future.
Yeah, he's off to London Irish. Leicester Tigers, sorry.
Yeah. And, London Irish are bottom of the league, aren't they?
Not confirmed yet, but highly touted.
Well, I said an interesting one is Launchbury ending up in Harlequins.
That is interesting.
Lovely move up.
It is a very good move. So everyone's saying Leicester Tigers?
Yeah, and I'm saying South Africa win, and the last game of the internationals is?
Wales host Australia.
I don't care.
But England-South Africa is interesting because South Africa player who plays for a European club will be unavailable.
Yep.
Which, it's not huge. They've still got lots of depth, but Vincent Cock, Trevor Nyakane, Jasper Visa, Kobus Reinach, Cheslin Kolbe, although he was injured this week, and Andre Esterhazen all return to their clubs. And so South Africa have called up a few players, including Thomas Tatoi, Marco van Staden, and Johan Usen.
Bloody hell, they're not bad, are they?
Not too bad.
I mean, on paper, at least, they're brilliant. Marco van Staden, Johan Usen in particular.
Yeah. So that will be interesting. England have got to just... Now, for 70 minutes this week... Oh, no. I'll rephrase that. For 40 minutes this week, England really struggled to do anything. And part of it was their inability for that first 40 to get on the front foot. And they're not going to be getting on the front foot any more against South Africa than they were against New Zealand. So they've got to find a way to do stuff without being dominant, getting over the gain line dominantly. That's why they've got to get that edge.
Excellent. Any more?
Australia are going to win. Australia are going to beat Wales.
Australia are going to beat Wales, and it's going to be bad times for Wales.
Tim, anything from Culture Corner? Anything you've been watching, reading, want to share with it? Share with anyone?
Yes, something I have been reading. So I was someone I've known for a while through radio, and he's a stand-up comedian, very, very funny guy, and he's written his second book called Billy No Mates. Max Dickens is called, and
okay.
It's a very, very funny book, and it's very pertinent to rugby actually. So I hosted a little event with him on Thursday night because it's November's a month when lots of male issues get thrown under the spotlight, and three quarters of men men. All the rest of it. So this book, Billy No Mates, it's really funny. I'll just pass it on to you when I finish reading it. I'm almost through it now.
Think I need it?
Basically, the concept is, the story of this book starts when he's going to propose to his, and they're now married, but he's going to propose to his other half, and he considers who his best man would be, and he realizes he doesn't really have anyone that's close, and he's worked really hard, and he hasn't nurtured his relationships, and it's basically just admitting I don't really have any friends. I've got lots of acquaintances, the friends that I used to have. And I think it's something which a lot of people, and in fact, his book goes on to say that a lot of people find themselves in this situation where they have people that they know through work, and they have some, but sort of actual meaningful relationships. They don't have many of them as men. And you end up, there's a comedian, I think he says that men don't have friends, they have wives who have husbands. and there's a lot to be said for that. The book's brilliant, but it just, as I read it, and we were doing this talk the other night, it made me realise just what an amazing place a rugby club is. Because yes, the just for fraternity and for relationships and stuff, which men actually find really hard to nurture. Just going down on a Tuesday night, if you're still playing, and on a Saturday, or just turning up at your club, and it's an amazing place where a lot of these issues that men find themselves in are solved, and the link between loneliness and health is absolutely stark. It's so that's kind of a sort of sincere. I don't think it's what you were quite expecting or asking for.
No, but I want to know what you've been doing. Which is great.
That's what I've been doing, and I would totally recommend the book Billy No Mates. Really good.
Yeah,
really
very funny. I've just looked it up. It is available on Amazon, so that would be a good Christmas gift as well.
The other thing in terms of Christmas gifts, that's the only other thing I'm going to say. Kate tonight has done with a friend of hers a Indian cooking course at a place in Didsbury. And she just sent me the pictures of, like, this is what I've cooked. There's food here. When you get back, you can eat this tomorrow. And it just made me think, it's getting someone a cooking course for Christmas, your other half a cooking course for Christmas, is the best gift, because it's actually a gift great for yourself.
Yes, it's a great idea.
That is very clever.
That is a great, great idea. Well, I've been reading the latest Peter Zion book, which is basically about the collapse of globalization. And that's why, Phil, I've been sending you all of those cheerful texts on a daily basis about how society is going to crumble before our eyes in the next decade. It's all about...
Give me the headline. I don't think you have to convince me of this, JB. I think I'm very much on board.
Yeah.
Give me the headlines on how it's going to crumble.
Demographic collapse in all the Western societies plus China, which will result in the collapse of trade, which will result in the collapse of... supply systems and intermediary goods crossing into international borders, and then basically all the shop shelves empty, and we go back to dark ages, effectively.
Mm.
When you say demographic collapse, is this a part? Because I know that birth rates are plummeting.
Yes, in Western countries. As is fertility.
Levels of testosterone and fertility are plummeting.
And you'd never get that countries. From Twitter, would you? You'd never read Twitter and think this is happening.
No, you wouldn't. But I think I mentioned last week, I've just started watching The Handmaid's Tale. And, the echoes.
Yeah, so I would really recommend the Peter Zion book. I think there's some holes
in it. How do you spell his surname?
Great question. Don't know. Do not know.
So if I type in the title, The Collapse of...
No, it is. The End of the World is Just the Beginning by Peter Zion. Zeihan.
The end of the world is just a bit, mapping the collapse of globalization.
Yeah, it's a really engaging book. And if nothing else, it's just an amazing book about the history of trade. Nothing else.
I hope we can look back and laugh at people like Peter Zion in the future and go, what were you thinking, mate? But yes. There's too many people at the minute who are saying things that sound outlandish that
are true.
Are very much coming true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that exceptionally bright...
Anything, Phil? Anything to add, Phil?
I will just mention one little thing as a... We kind of said as a stocking filler or as a gift, the Billy Nomates book. A chap I work with has developed his own product that is currently available on Amazon as a little stocking filler.
What is it?
It's called Flicker. Flicker. It's a light switch attachment.
This is so Langer Rourke.
This is pretty cool. So you stick it on your light switch, the light switch over there in the corner.
Yep.
It's got two targets, one at the top and one at the bottom, and some little bean balls, and you can use it to throw and turn your light switches on and off.
Wow.
Or get a like a Nerf dart or something like that.
That is astounding.
I need to see this now. What?
It's about 10 quid from Amazon, and it would be a very good little stocking filler for Louis or anyone. So
Flicker.
Yeah.
Is it double K?
Double K, yeah. Flicker with double K. Flicker light switch attachment.
Light switch game it's come up as.
Yeah. It's quite cool. So have a little look at that.
Oh, that... Yeah, that's neat.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing.
Wow. Does he... Like, has he sold many? Is he making, like, money off that?
That's a very good question. He's not sold many yet. It's only been on Amazon for a matter of weeks or even days. But he's hoping to sell a few before Christmas. And
is that the sort of thing that you... There's no IP you can have on that, can you? Because it's just a... How can you... Sort of, what's the word? Patent. I have a thing that you lob at a light.
Yeah. Well, the connection onto the light fitting is. I can't remember if he's actually got it patented. But yeah, it's quite good fun. Quite an interesting little toy.
Astounding.
Yeah.
Astounding. Right. Well, on that note, let's call it a day.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for doing all those things. And we will see you next week with even more rugby. Goodbye.
Yeah. Good work.
Right.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.